You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
I'm good.
The world got difficult there all of a sudden. I don't know what happened. Joining me now is, I didn't know it, but we're battle buddies. Pat Murray. Yeah, no kidding. We found out yesterday. I was probably, in some way, shape, or form, part of Pat's medevac out of the theater. So I was working in the Combat Operations Center in Fallujah in September of 2006. When Pat was wounded. So Pat Murray joins us. Pat, welcome to All Marine Radio. Thanks for doing this.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
The we need to learn about you, Pat, before we talk about Turner Construction and your time there and transitioning out of the Marine Corps. Talk to me about born and raised where?
So I was born and raised in North Kingstown, Rhode Island.
North Kingstown, Rhode Island. How big a city is that?
It's about 20,000 people. It's not a huge town. It's not one of those like one stoplight places, but it's pretty small. So.
Yeah. You've got like five or six stoplights in that place. Come on, you guys.
I think it's about 10, if we're being honest. It's not 100. It's probably close to 10.
All right. But it's not one. All right. It's not one and sure as hell not a stop sign. Okay. It's a
little. No, exactly.
All right. How does the Marine Corps get on your horizon growing up there?
So, my biggest hero, right, the guy I always looked up to when I was growing up is my grandfather, Big Joe. And he was a Marine in Korea with the 1st Marine Division, landed at Incheon, and fought and was wounded shortly after Chosin. So, growing up,
he fought through the Chosin Reservoir and then got wounded?
Yes, it's one of those things that, you know, when you're growing up, when you're a small child, his generation didn't love to talk about things like that.
Right.
So the stories that I heard was always, Big Joe hated the cold. And now, as I'm old enough to know why, it makes a lot of sense. So things like that, he hated the rain because after Chosin, he made it to, I guess, the rainy season where he said it just rained for, forever. But that was who I always looked up to because he was the toughest guy, he was the smartest guy, everything about him. So growing up, Big Joe was always put on a pedestal because he was a Marine. So fast forward to 2003, I was at the University of Rhode Island and I had about 3 friends get called up through various reserve units or National Guard, whatever it might be, to head over to Iraq. And that's kind of when I realized, hey, why are all my friends going off to war and I'm sitting here doing nothing? So.
And I've got Big Joe's blood pumping through my veins.
Yeah. So it was just a real simple, simple decision. Just walked down to the Marine Corps recruiting station and just said, I'm interested. They tried to give me the whole, let me tell you what being a Marine can do for you. And I was like, yeah, that's great. I'm in. And they still tried to give me the, tell me what honor means and tell me what commitment means. I'm like, guys, I said I'm in. Where's the, So I was maybe the easiest sell they had that week. Went home that night, called my folks, said, hey, I'm coming home for dinner, got some news. And when I told my folks, my mother lost it. Like maybe a lot of folks, a lot of Marines, their parents weren't maybe ecstatic that there's a war about to kick off and I decided to join the Marine Corps. So, after a little bit, when I told them what I was thinking, they kind of came around to it, but my mom still wasn't thrilled. So,
yeah. My dad was not exactly impressed with the whole event. He said, why the Marines? He said, they're stupid. They can't pour piss out of a boot. I said, what? He said, you heard me? I said, Dad, they're the best. He goes, good God. He said, tell me you haven't signed a contract.
Oh, well.
I said, yeah, that might be too late for that.
that conversation, the same thing. You know, did you sign anything yet? And I'm like, actually, I did. And my mother's first response is, we got to get a lawyer. I was like, I don't think that's how it works, Mom. I'm over 18. I think I'm good.
Now, how old were you?
19.
So you're 19 years old. And that's too funny. What year is it?
2003.
So it's 2003. Have we done the march up? Have we done the march up yet?
They just did. Okay. So I think I went to the recruiting office in either February or March, and told them I'm in. You know, I wasn't necessarily like I'm in today. I said I'm going to school right now. So I'm in May, you know, call me right after my classes. And I left a week after I finished up that semester to go to boot camp.
All right. So you go to boot camp. What do you become in the Marine Corps?
Machine gunner, 0331.
Home of the badasses, machine gunners. You're an 0331. And then where do you go? You get sent to the operating forces and,
talked to the recruiter, told them kind of my life plan was, I wanted to join the Marines and I wanted to, the other dream I had is, become a firefighter. That's what my father was for 30 years.
Oh.
And I had a slot in, the fire academy at the time. So, I took the test, did the physical, everything like that. And I was good to go. So I told them, how do I do both? And they're basically the answer was you can do the reserves. So you could join the Marine Corps and still pursue that avenue. So that's why I picked, join the reserves, and I was in, 1st Battalion, 25th Marines.
Okay, so you're in the reserve. So, let's fast forward to, 1st Battalion, 25th Marines, right?
Yep.
Famous for, taking part in the fight on, Iwo Jima. And,
yep.
Also they fought in Vietnam, yes?
Yes.
All right, so a pretty, a famous one, we have these reserve battalions that have incredible history with them, incredible history with them. And, again, a lot of them were resident on Iwo Jima when they stood up. The 4th Marine Division and the 5th Marine Division were parts of the Marine Corps. They no longer exist.
The 3rd, the 4th, and the 5th Divisions invaded Iwo Jima, I believe.
Right.
And I think 4th Division and 125 was on the right side. They weren't. So if you're looking at Mount Suribachi on the left, I think 125, I believe, was to the right of the beach.
Right.
So I believe they went towards the airfield.
Right. They hooked a right actually before the airfield, and there's things called the turkey knob, the meat grinder.
Yep.
And I swear to God, if you watch the battle move on a daily basis, those guys don't move. They measured progress in feet, literally.
Yeah.
Feet
yeah.
per day. And they, the Japanese had drilled so far down into the ground. And the tunnel system was so complex that you look at it and you're like, why didn't those guys move? And then you read the day-to-day reports and you're like, good God. I mean, they're killing people. People are getting killed. And it just goes like that. That's hence they called it the meat grinder up there.
Yeah.
The amphitheater is one of the places up there.
Yeah, that area was where they'd move forward and then have to come back because, the tunnel system, they were just, picking up their old fighting spots. Behind the Marines in some cases. It was incredible what they had to go through.
All right, so you're a machine gunner, so you're a badass, and you're part of 125. When do you guys find out that you're going to deploy to Iraq? And what was it like when you heard the F word, that you were going to the city of Fallujah, which, had been in the news and had been the subject of much fighting?
Yeah, so we got activated so it would be December 1st, 2005, and I think we probably knew in the spring 2005. So, that we were told it's not official yet, but it's going to be, get ready, this and that. So I think I was with the unit for about a year and a half before, we started getting word that we're going overseas. As it got closer, they said it's either Ramadi or Fallujah. And You know, I mean, obviously, you know, all you got to do is just turn on the news. And, you know, any idiot can see that, well, those are two pretty crappy spots.
Hey, let me tell you, that's an insult to every crappy place in the world. There's way. That was not even close to the inappropriate description of those shitholes.
So we started just getting ready, and you know, I did the thing. I told my folks, I think I was, you know, we're heading to Kuwait. Don't worry, it's not going to be a big deal. All the while, as it got closer, we knew, like, it's going to be Fallujah. So, you know, like, I knew, didn't really tell any of my family because I didn't want them to worry. It's the same thing. They can turn on the news, too, and see that that's a shithole. So, you know, as we're heading overseas, you know, obviously you're a little bit anxious, a little bit nervous, not really sure what to expect. We actually had guys from the unit that was there maybe 6 months before, whatever it was, come and talk to us, and they did a great job of making us all piss our pants because they told us, hey, if you're a turret gunner, you're going to get wounded. And guess what I was? So you're just gunner. Sitting there like, ah, for fuck's sake. You kidding me? So, you know, like that, obviously, you know, things like that, you know, it helps prepare you mentally, you know, maybe put the fear of God in you a little so that you're not, you know, taking it too lightly, you know, taking it as appropriately as you should. And, you know, I just remember the first helicopter ride in there, I was like, oh, here we go. You know, I got the opportunity to helo in from where we landed in TQ, but we had some of our other Marines come in on convoys, and they were getting shot up. So they were in country for hours, and they were getting shot at. So, you know, it really hit home pretty quickly.
Right. In those days, we used to land at either TQ or Al Asad, and most of the guys in 125 would have landed at TQ. And I don't know, did they bring you across the city, or did they still go around Ramadi on Route Mobile? Do you remember?
I think they went mobile.
Yeah.
Like I said, I was one of the ones in the helo, so. And especially those first couple weeks as you're starting to learn the geography.
Right.
I don't know what road they were taking in. You know, I think it was mobile, but, you know, like I said, I was one of the ones that wasn't shot at within the first 10 hours of being there.
But it is sobering, right? You're going to now walk in the footsteps of your uncle.
Yeah, it really was, you know. And, you know, I got a letter from, you know, my aunt was in the Navy. My uncle was also in the Marines. A letter that, you know, they said, like, hey, heads up, war isn't glorious. It's not the movies. And, you know, that was, you know, I also thought I was a little bit invincible. But, you know, you also kind of have to take that to heart that, yeah, you're right. And those first couple weeks, you really hit home. They're right. This is not the movies. This is not glorious. This is kind of dirty, and this is nasty. So,
talk to me about, as you guys, so what did your company do? What did your platoon do in the area?
So I was in a weapons company, and what they did was they basically took all the, it was around the time when they were just turning everyone into mobile assault platoons.
Right.
So they took the machine gunners, the mortarmen, the jabs guys, and toes, and just put us all into cat platoons. And, you know, it was on us to teach, you know, the 0340 ones, hey, this is a 50 cal. Here's what happens when it misfires. Here's how you load it. Here's how you clean it. Here's how you do this. So the workup was a lot of instruction for our guys that didn't know, you know, how to work a Mark 19. Had a basic knowledge of a 240, but nothing crazy. So, you know, that was what we did beforehand. And then when we got there, it was some route clearance. We were the QRF for our battalion. We were the medevacs for a lot of our other companies. And we were just piecemealed out to patrol different areas of the city, different days, and, you know, just figure it out, learn the area, and kind of start to learn where the places may be to keep your head down, just where the guys might be, and, you know, so on and so forth. So,
all right. So one other kind of epiphany that the guys have is normally – whether it's 30, 60, 90 days in, you realize that this might be a little bit more about luck than it is about skill. Do you remember a time when you looked around and said, you know what, I'm not exactly sure if I'm going to go home. Did you ever have a clear thought like that?
Yeah. One of our, it might have been our third platoon, took a massive blast on, Route Mobile. And, I forget if it was the driver's side or the rear door on the right side of the vehicle. The door was smashed. The door was pretty much intact and the ballistic glass was bowed in. It looks like a bowl. And I just remember when they came back, I just took a look at that and just said, like, holy hell. And it was one of the first big IEDs we really got. And I said, like, that's what we're up against? Uh-oh. And thankfully everyone was okay in the explosion. They had some headaches, maybe a couple concussions. But that was the first moment when it really sunk home of, you know, they showed us all the videos and pictures you could imagine beforehand, but seeing it firsthand was eye-opening. That was the moment when I said, I'm up in the turret, and I've got those things to worry about? Oh, man. In the moment, you also just have to kind of shake it off and just say, well, I mean, I hope someone's watching over me.
Right.
Because I'm not skilled enough to avoid that bomb. So if it does happen, I hope I'm okay.
My guest today is the one and only Pat Murray from Rhode Island, and he currently works for the VFW up on Capitol Hill. He's a lobbyist, so he's now part of the problem, but we're going to talk about Turner Construction and its role in his return to civilian life and his transition. Tell us about getting wounded. What happened? How did you get wounded?
So the morning of September 4th, 2006, we had to do some, it was basically, clear the area. One of our Marines from our Charlie company was unfortunately shot and killed, so they were doing their memorial service. And it was weapons company's job to kind of scatter around the different areas surrounding their FOB to make sure that no one's going to take pot shots at the company, shoot some mortars in while they're outside for their memorial service. About 7, 8 in the morning, one of our vehicles from our third platoon hit a hell of an IED. It was a belly shot, and it killed two Marines, a corpsman, and seriously wounded, badly burned another Marine. So the rest of the day then was the recovery operation, security for that, and we were there for about 12 hours. So by the end of the day, we were smoked. It was hot, long, mentally taxing, emotionally taxing. So on the ride back to base, I looked at my driver and I just told him, get up in the turret. I'll take care of the ride back to base. We're good. You're smoked. Don't worry about it. We headed back to return to base. And we hit a very similar belly shot, in our vehicle. It wounded myself, my section leader. So I got, ended up with, right leg amputation. He ended up with a left leg amputation. My driver that was in the turret got burned, cut, bruised, but was a massive concussion, but was generally okay, able to walk away from it. And that was our, they buried that bitch right in the middle of the road, and it was right at dusk when you couldn't really see that well with the NVGs. It was that time when, do you wear the goggles, do you not? And we didn't see it at all. So that was the blast that got us on September 4th.
Let me just read you an email. Hey, Mac, I've never served in Iraq or Afghanistan. I just heard Pat say that they were there for 12 hours. What could possibly take 12 hours to do if once an IED went off and destroyed the vehicle? First of all, there's no fire department or anything like that if the vehicle catches on fire, you know. So you stay with the vehicle while it burns, and then after that, EOD's got to roll in, and EOD's got to do their thing. First of all, you're medevac people, then you deal with a fire, and then the vehicle's got to cool down before you can touch it, and EOD can go in there. So, I mean, it's not like here in the United States where you have all these agencies that come and put out fires and do things for you. It ain't that way.
No. I mean, if a car ends up catching on fire on the side of the road, you're right. Fire department's there within maybe 10 minutes.
Right.
They're putting it out, and then, you know, you see the wrecker come. But unfortunately, the morbid part of it was a serious blast, and you're right. The truck was on fire. My platoon was not the first on scene. It was our fourth platoon. And they were quick enough that they got the driver out as the vehicle was blazing hot, you know, flames two stories high. So our fourth platoon, you know, got him to Fallujah Surgical as quickly as they could. But then as we rolled up, you know, a couple minutes later, there was nothing you could do. The vehicle was fully engulfed. You just had to wait for the fire to go out. I don't even know. We had a couple of fire extinguishers on different of our vehicles, but it wouldn't have done you know, that's a drop in the bucket.
Yeah,
so
it's like pissing in a forest fire. And,
yeah,
you know,
it would have, you know, done nothing. So you had to wait for the fire to go out. Then you're right, EOD had to show up. And then the other thing was our mortuary affairs unit had to show up, and there were Marines around that vehicle for the whole time, because there were fallen Marines and a corpsman inside the vehicle. So they had to make sure that our friends were taken care of properly, their remains were treated respectfully, and that they got them home. That's a big thing, that, you know, you have to just make sure that their guys are being treated as best you can, obviously. So,
another piece of this is, one of the things that in Iraq, those guys knew what to do. They weren't great shots a lot of times, thankfully, but they knew what to do in terms of how to get after you. And when this stuff would happen, you know, you knew that there was going to be other incidents, whether they shot mortars at you, whether they moved snipers in there, because they knew that if that vehicle was on fire, it wasn't going anywhere, and there was going to be Marines there. And there was a greater chance that you were going to get into more stuff as they brought different assets that they had to bear to make your life miserable. And so hard, rough days, and you know when it happens, you know you're in, you know it's going to be one of those days.
Yeah, and they did. It was our third platoon that got a vehicle hit. Our fourth platoon and myself, we were first platoon. We were the first ones there, and then our Charlie company sent out about two or three platoons. There were about 200 Marines in and around the surrounding blocks, because you're right, we knew this is the beginning. We have a vehicle that is now stuck here with Marines inside that we need to take care of. So there's going to be a presence at that spot for the next however many hours. So we flooded the area, and sure enough, started taking pot shots from different areas. There was a rocket that hit another vehicle, you know, a few hours later. And it was a bad day. You know, those, you know, friends of mine that are no longer here now. But you had to kind of detach yourself from it, and it didn't really hit until about 4 or 5 hours later when, you know, we were inside a building, you know, pulling up an OP just up on the roof, that I remember talking to my platoon sergeant, and I said, like, which ones were it? Because I didn't know. I knew they called over two Marines, one Navy. And that could have been two different vehicles in that platoon, all of which were my friends. So until we were sitting on that roof and I just asked them, who was it? That's when it really hit. And that was hours later. Just because the adrenaline, you know, just having to do your job, some anger, obviously. But really, it was down to, okay, this just happened. What's next? We know this is going to happen. We know this is going to happen. So we need to be on point because we're about to take shots next. It was something surreal, that, you know, unless you go through something like that, it's hard to explain. It's hard to describe.
Right.
So on the back end of that event, you're driving on the way back to your base. Was what your base was?
Camp Barria.
Barria, which is just, it was in the, it was part of the Camp Fallujah complex, if you will.
Yeah.
It was outside of Camp Fallujah proper, and they had a lake over there, by the way. So,
a lake we weren't allowed to swim in because
somebody
dropped a couple dead bodies in there.
Yeah. And then I want to say an interpreter went swimming in there, or somebody went swimming in there and then drowned, which wasn't a good day there. That might have been before you guys got there. Not good. So, maybe this interview wasn't a good idea. So my guest, Pat Murray, Sergeant, United States Marine Corps, retired, currently
Corporal.
Corporal, United States Marine Corps.
I don't want to
steal rank. That's all right. What the hell good is the title if you're not getting paid for it anyway, Pat?
Yeah, exactly.
So he's currently working for the VFW on Capitol Hill as a lobbyist, and we'll talk about that here in a few minutes. But so you get wounded. What do you remember about getting wounded?
Actually, most of it. I was, I don't know if it's a fortunate or unfortunate thing, but I kind of got shot out the driver's side door like a champagne cork, and was lucky enough to have a curb break my fall. So it was like a normal convoy back to base. And like I said, it was a belly shot that hit right underneath our engine block and blasted me out the side door. I just remember laying there and almost sailing through the air. As soon as I hit the ground, I think I said to myself, like, I think we just hit an IED. You know, like as I'm outside the vehicle now laying on the street, like, yeah, no shit, buddy. But I just remember laying there, and my first thought was, it was crazy, but, you know, I hope these guys don't leave me.
Wow.
You know, because the rest of the 8th vehicle in our platoon just drove by. And my helmet was smashed over my face, so I quickly took that off as best I could. My hands were burned, so I couldn't really do much there. My right leg was smashed. So at first I tried to sit up. And the amount of broken bones I had, the, you know, massive concussion I just took to my body, I really couldn't move at all. So, I just kind of just laid there for a couple seconds, you know, trying to take inventory of what the hell just happened to me. And that's when machine guns and rockets from both sides of the street started going off. So I quit trying to get back underneath that helmet just lay there. I was next to the curb, you know, the 6 or 8 inch curbs
right.
They had in the middle of the streets, and I hugged that thing as close as I could because, you know, I've heard all the stories. Guys get hit, they get injured, and their first thing is they grab their weapon and, you know, get me back in the fight. Well, my weapon was in a truck that was burning about 50 yards away, so I had a pocket knife and burned hand. So I was like, well, I'm not really going to do anything here. Duck? So I just kind of lay there until a couple my buddies just came running up, and, you know, like, I just remember yelling out, like, hey, it's Murray, I'm good. And the first guy was this guy, Scott Parrish, Sergeant Parrish, and he just came up and he goes, no, you're not. So he and another guy, Corporal Wales, grabbed me and just started dragging me back to our corpsman. It was everything of, you know, bullets bouncing around the streets, Marines running around, then returning fire, explosions, and it was a hell of a fight that, unfortunately, I was laying on my back for. So, a little bummed about that, but my Marines and corpsmen took excellent care of me, and Sergeant Burke, my section leader, and, couldn't ask for better guys.
You know what, and... Marines, when that stuff happened, you thank God you joined the Marine Corps because they come, doesn't matter what's going on. Right? They'll come, they'll die. It doesn't matter. It's the most intoxicating thing to be around in your life.
Yeah, guys were just, you know, I read stories every now and then that, you know, so-and-so exposed himself to fire to, you know, get the wounded soldiers or Marines, whatever. And I'm like, that was like half my platoon. All these guys are just running around, like there are bullets flying every which way, and they're just, I don't even know if they thought about it. It was, hey, Pat's lying in the street over there, Shane's lying in the street over there. The guy that was up in the turret, Lance Corporal Goldman, John, he was just wandering around. He was probably concussed to hell. But just wandering around, and guys just ran out and grabbed him, you know, get him behind the truck. It was just immediate action. And, you know, we train for that. We do that for each other. That's not in that moment, it wasn't like a heroic thing. It wasn't some extraordinarily brave thing. They were just doing it because that's what you do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, in my opinion, they all should have gotten medals. I don't know. I'm not in charge of that stuff. Right. But, you know, they were out there exposing themselves to take care of myself and the rest of my truck. And, you know, I always loved those guys for that because, man, that's a scary thing to do. And they just did it without hesitation.
Corporal Pat Murray, United States Marine Corps, retired medically. So you get back to Bethesda. You go through that whole process. You're medically discharged. Can you still be part of the fire department? Is that dream automatically over? Talk to us about how you found your way to Turner.
So, within the first few weeks, you know, after I got out, I was, you know, high as a kite on, you know, a list of different drugs. But once I finally came around to it, I was very fortunate. My mother and father came down to spend about, you know, the first couple of months, make sure I was okay. And talking to my father, you know, he was, like I said, a firefighter for 30 years. You know, I was talking about, hey, can I still do this? And, you know, it was kind of one of those tough conversations where, I mean, basically he said no. Or if I did, it was going to have to be like an extraordinary effort on my part in order to do it, just to meet the basic minimum requirements.
Right. Hey, Pat, where is your amputation, above the knee or below the knee?
Above the knee, and that's what makes it a little bit more difficult.
Right.
If it were below the knee, maybe it would be very hard still, but possible. With the above the knee not having two joints, then you're a lot more unstable. And, you know, we were just talking about it that, you know, he said, do you think you're going to be able to carry someone out of a window on a ladder? And I just said, I don't think so. Do you think you're going to be able to carry, 100 pounds of hose up the stairs, you know, a couple flights of stairs? And I said, nope. So, you know, that was, you know, a tough realization that, you know, this thing that I wanted to be since I was a kid, you know, I always sat in the fire truck with my dad and did this, that I'm going to need something new. That I need to, you know, pivot and do something entirely different. So, while I was at Walter Reed, I actually got to meet some great folks. One of them was Bob Nilsen. Bob was peer mentor there.
Don't pump don't pump his tire, okay? The last thing that guy needs is his tire pumped, okay?
So, you know, we used to have lunch every day. Myself, Bob, and a couple of other guys. Chris Santiago and Josh Weil. And, you know, as it was getting close to me getting out, you know, I expressed I need to finish up my degree. I don't want to do this. I don't want to do that. But in terms of employment, you know, I said, like, you know, I'm open. I'm going to be looking. So he suggested that, you know, I go take a trip down to one of the Turner job sites and, you know, just check it out, see what it was all about. I met a few folks that work for them. And, you know, I came back to Bob and I said, this is something that I was obviously a little concerned. You know, but he said physically I'm able to do it. You know, really a lot of it is just, you know, you need to be mentally, with it that, you know, you're not going to be framing houses. You're not going to be swinging an hammer. You're not going to be digging holes, that you're there for supervisory stuff. So that's where you need your, you know, to get your, you know, ducks in a row in terms of organization, leadership, you know, using your head as opposed to using your skills with the tools. So, you know, when I got out, went and did a couple of interviews, and sure enough, you know, they, I don't know why, but they liked me enough to bring me on board. And, I had a hell of a learning curve. The first couple weeks on the job, I was way over my head. But I was fortunate enough with Turner that, I mean, they gave me some great mentors, some great folks to learn from, and also gave me the opportunity to grow very quickly. So, you know, I was incredibly grateful for the opportunity, but then it was time to put that gratefulness, you know, put that aside. Now you got to do your job. And, it was fun, you know, the first big project I was on was Fort Belvoir Community Hospital.
Wow.
And it's a billion-dollar hospital with, I think we had 2,000 or 2,500 workers on it at one point. And I was there from, you know, groundbreaking to ribbon cutting. And it was a great project, great people, and it's a great product. The hospital is fantastic. So I was very fortunate.
The So talk to me. So for guys who and Turner is looking to hire 40 to 50 veterans, and in talking with Bob, you know, not that it's mandatory, but they lean towards giving combat veterans an opportunity to go ahead and kind of seize these opportunities. How did, you know, the responsibility and the leadership that you exercise, was that a good fit, and was that what Turner was looking for, as opposed to, you know, me to, you know, carry a shovel or swing a hammer? And how much was your leadership experience and the leadership you were exposed to in the Marine Corps, how much was that a benefit as you kind of went to work for Turner?
So one of the things I learned that was very beneficial that I took from the Marine Corps was, and, you know, some people will call it one thing, but it was the confidence in order to do it. You know, every job that I was ever given, you know, you get to watch someone do it for a little bit, and then, you know, the Marine Corps is very much, okay, you're now in charge of this. Okay, you go. So the confidence that, you know, all the tasks they gave me in the Marine Corps, okay, I've got it, I can do it now, carried over with that obviously there's a little bit of a learning curve. Then, all right, I got it, time to go. And that's kind of the way that Turner treated it as well, that, you know, they set me up to learn and then gave me the opportunity to grow with responsibility, with leadership. You know, it's obviously similar things that when you're just managing people and personalities. And, you know, the Marine Corps is a lot of that as well, that you need to know who's your guy that you can go to deal with this, who's your guy that you trust, who's the guy that maybe you have to watch, whatever it might be. That it's very similar when I was at Turner. It was just a larger scale. So being the senior machine gunner in my platoon, you know, I think there were 5 or 6 machine gunners. Well, then at one point on a project, I had 100 electricians, plumbers, pipe fitters, drywall, masons, whatever it was. So it's a bigger scale, but it's the same thing.
Right.
That just learning how to just deal with people. I took a lot of my Marine Corps experience was, you know, just, it was people driven. And that's really what Turner was as well. That everybody, all the tradesmen wanted to get in to this building and do their work, and everyone just stay out of my way. Well, that's not how it works. Everyone has to play nice in the sandbox. So we're going to get together, we're going to talk about it, and then we're going to go execute our plan, and I'm going to sit there and make sure that we're doing it. So really, it's a lot of organization and teamwork, which are, you know, two things the Marine Corps is built on. And within that sense, it was an easy transition. It was kind of fun.
My guest is Pat Murray, Corporal of the United States Marine Corps, retired, and currently with the VFW, working on Capitol Hill as a lobbyist. As I said before, he's now part of the problem. So happy to have Pat on. Here's a Facebook question. Please ask Pat about the company he and Chris Santiago formed while still in rehab. at old Walter Reed. So tell me about what company did you form?
I want to know who asked this one. But so Chris and I formed.
Well, let me tell you. I'm not going to tell you his name, but you were about to pump his tire before I intervened. So
okay. Chris Santiago, Marine from, I believe it was 2-8, was a good friend of mine, and we spent our time at Walter Reed together. He was a double amputee, I was a single amputee, so we formed our company, 213 Incorporated. What was it? Two chumps, one leg, three stumps. We started it as a joke because when we were at Walter Reed, this is during the time when the article about how bad Walter Reed was came out,
right?
2007, and we could talk about that at a later point.
Sure.
But what that started was a lot of people coming then to go check up on Walter Reed. So it was a lot of senators, a lot of congressmen, generals, colonels, you name it, everybody coming to make sure that, you know, everything's taken care of. So these guys would come around and, you know, they'd talk to us. Sometimes it was just, you know, a photo op. But a lot of times, you know, they'd, hey, here's my card, whatever. So Chris and I were joking around that we need business cards made up so we can hand them back to these guys. So we had the 213 business cards made up. I believe it was, part-time human bomb detectors, professional cigarette smokers. And on the back, it said, yes, we're fucking serious. So we would hand those to Representative so-and-so that came by to shake our hands, and some of them were a little taken aback. So a lot of fun. We also had the T-shirts made up that said Marine for sale, 25 to 50% off. And on the back, it said some assembly required.
You know what, people aren't sure what to make of that stuff. I mean, it doesn't bother us, right? We laugh.
No.
Because you know how you'll be, like, I'll be out and about with my kids, and I'll see somebody, you know, a young guy with an amputation, and you'll see him, and you'll just say, hey, man, where'd you get that? I got that in Helmand Province of Afghanistan. Oh, really, what year? 2010. Where were you? I was outside of Marja. Oh, really? What unit? And all of a sudden, it's like, I was there at the same time. You know, and it's our tribe. You know what I mean? It's how we relate to each other. But it's a little bit intimidating when you're not familiar with that. And you see that stuff.
It's all about, so one of the things that really helped in the recovery was the Marines at Walter Reed were a pretty tight group because it was an Army hospital and there were, you know, 50 Army amputees and 200 regular wounded guys. And also Walter Reed at the time was just a general hospital. So guys were there, you know, let's say they blew their knee out on a PT test, right? They were also at Walter Reed. So there were so many Army dudes there, and there were about 20, 25 Marines at the time. And we were a pretty tight-knit group and also pretty hard on each other. You know, if a guy fell down during PT, you know, other people might say, ooh, is he okay? And, you know, you look over in the corner, the Marines are pointing and laughing at him. You know, what's the matter? Can't stand up? So part of the humor, you know, gallows humor, was what kind of made you toughen up a little bit, realize that, hey, this isn't the end of the world either. You know,
well,
put a smile on and,
hey,
you know, keep
hey, Pat,
going.
Let me ask you, people ask that, you know, when they see you guys – and in groups and they hear you guys laughing and talking and they're almost a little bit surprised by it. And one of the things that I tell people, whether they be family members or other friends that are exposed to that, is like, hey, look, they know they're lucky.
Oh yeah.
Right. You might see them as a loss of a leg, but trust me, they know they're lucky. And you get this look like, are you crazy? What do you mean? Right?
I mean, as I told you, you know, a vehicle from our third platoon hit a very similar bomb, and there were three casualties, you know, three KIA, one incredibly, you know, badly wounded.
Right.
And then our truck hit a very similar one that night, and we're all alive.
Right.
And, trust me, that doesn't get lost on me at all. And I know that I'm lucky. I'm fortunate. That was part of what I think made my recovery mentally a little bit easier. Because some guys might be down on themselves. Some guys might be upset. You know, obviously it's a life-changing event. But, man, I'm here. And I shouldn't be. So, okay, I'm good. You know, I've got a metal leg now. Fine. You know what? That's better than not being here. So a lot of us had that mentality. You know, it helped. It really helped with the mental recovery. And, you know, there's so much that goes into the recovery that sometimes you just need to laugh about it. Because, you know, I've been walking since I was 2. And then I needed help from my mother to walk 5 feet. You know, what a change that is. That's kind of pretty fucked up. So, you know, but you just laugh about it. That, man, this is weird. And if, you know, you're right. People all the time would see us in groups, whatever it was, or even just, you know, individually. And you could tell they're, you know, they're kind of looking out of the corner of their eye, not really sure what to say. And I always take it as an opportunity just to have fun. You know, a little kid will come up and you'd be surprised. Some of these get, you know, they just want to touch the metal leg. They'll kind of sneakily kind of slide their hand over and see if they can poke it real quick. You know, and I'll just tell them, like, hey, that's what happens when you don't eat your vegetables. You know, and now you've got this 5-year-old kid looking up at his mom or dad like, oh, my God, is that true? Like, yeah.
Well, no, but, you know, but the message is, hey, it's okay. Right?
Yeah, and I try that countless times, and it's always in airports. I'm not really sure why, but it's always in airports right. That, you know, you see the little kid or, you know, even adults, whatever, they're looking at it and they're not sure what to say. And, you know, hey, I don't want you to feel weird because I'm just sitting here reading a book. You know, I'll just crack a joke or talk to them real quick, whatever it is. And, you know, let them know, like, you know, you don't need to feel weird. You know, you're not the one with the metal leg. You know, like, chill out. It's not that bad. So, you know, there's all kinds of fun things you can do. Whenever you're in an elevator and the door starts to close, you know, folks that throw their hand in it, that's a great opportunity to tell them you can lose a limb that way.
Right, right.
And
right,
then just
right.
Point down your leg. And they think you're serious. It's awesome.
Let me read you an email. Hey, Mac. Awesome hearing Pat on this morning. I love when you have veterans on, especially guys that have been through such an ordeal and have come out well on the far side. I know it's not easy, but I think we too often read only about veterans who struggle. And obviously, Pat has come through this and sounds like he's doing great. My question is about Turner. Would he recommend it? I have no construction background at all. It seems to be a little bit intimidating. I never even thought that my leadership skills would be utilized in a company like that because of the construction piece. Knowing nothing about construction, would he recommend that I give them a call and get after this? So, Pat?
Yeah. So I didn't know very much about construction either. And like I said, it was a very steep learning curve. If you're willing to, you know, really buckle down and learn and realize that day one, you're going to be an outsider. You don't know what you're talking about. I was linked up with a guy who had been in construction for longer than I was alive. You know, so, you know, this guy that's 60 years old and here's this 25-year-old kid that, you know, he now needs to teach, you know, about line and grade and just some very simple things of okay, this is what we're doing with this dirt, right? I-beams and, you know, heavy concrete pours or foundation, you know, you name it. It was heavy construction. If that's something he's interested in, absolutely do a little bit of homework on it and maybe try it. It's a lot of organizational stuff that I wasn't the expert, but I worked with experts. And if you're the kind of guy that can take a step back and say, hey, I don't know the answer to this, but I know who does. So you go find that person, you learn from them, and then you start to slowly, you know, gain a little bit more info as you go so that you can start to have those answers on your own. But really the biggest thing is making sure that everybody does what they're supposed to do and everybody works and coordinates together. If that's something that you know, interests them, absolutely. Turner's a great company.
Really?
So it's not, should you go work for Turner? It's, are you interested in construction? And other companies, obviously, are good as well, and you do the same job. So if you're interested in that field, I obviously highly suggest Turner. But it's, you need to figure out, are you interested in that field?
Right, right, right. All right. And so you wouldn't be afraid, you wouldn't be afraid to go there and, because for a lot of guys, I would sympathize with that. It's like, geez, I never thought about providing my leadership skills for a company that does construction, but, you know, it has things that I'm familiar with. I like being outdoors. I like working with crews of you know, men and women who, you know, who we work with our hands. We do stuff. I like that being a part of my job, as well as problem solving and other things. It sounds very much like being an NCO or a junior officer in the Marine Corps. You know, I'm gonna command a crew. I'm gonna coordinate. I'm gonna problem solve. I'm taking care of them. It's
actually
a lot of the things that I've done in my life sounds like a resident in that job.
You're absolutely right. And the best way to maybe think about it, you know, you kind of hit on it, that, you know, being an NCO, being a platoon sergeant. You know, imagine you've got these group of guys that you need to know them. You need to, like I said, you need to know who's your go-to guy, who are your, you know, solid Marines, who are your booger Marines, who are the ones that are like, I gotta watch that guy. I don't trust that fucker. But like, you know, sometimes you've got that, and, that's just what it is. It's moving around the different pieces to make sure that if you have 50 guys that are working in your building, all 50 are working at once, because it's a waste of money if you have to send home, you know, the drywall guys because the electrician isn't finished yet. So you need to try to make sure that the workflow goes, you know, one after the other after the other, because if people aren't working, you're losing money. So trying to make everyone work as efficiently as possible, is just something that's, it's a challenge, but it's fun, because what you're doing every day is your problem solving. If building, you know, those buildings, if completing those projects was simple, I wouldn't have had a job. You know, the electricians would have gone in, and, you know, the steel guys would have gone in, and the concrete guys would have gone in, and they'd have just done it. The thing is, there's problems all the time, and you just need to sit there and day-to-day problem solve. How are we going to make this work? How are we going to get you from point A to point B while keeping, you know, with respect to the other trades, the other guys that are working? It's a lot of fun, and it's, you know, it's challenging, but if that's something they're interested in, by all means, give it a shot.
All right. Hey, Pat, would you mind if our time is up, but would you mind if I give you a call and we'll have you back on? I'd love to hear about what you do with the VFW now and the lobbying stuff, and you can make us smart on some current issues if you don't mind.
That would be fantastic.
All right, but first of all, I want to thank you for doing this. As a battle buddy, as somebody who is in Fallujah at the same time as you, I watched 1st Battalion, 25th Marines fight every day. And whether it was at the down at the CMOC and the gong show that used to go on around there, whether it was soft raids in and out of the vicinity every night, whether it was them responding to, I remember, stoning on the south side of the city one day. You know, all the different things that these guys did in and around the city. And then you know, old names come to mind. The Cloverleaf, the Pizza Slice, the Blue Mosque. Martyr Cemetery.
The hospital. The industrial sector.
Right. All those things that come to mind when you were talking. So, first of all, God bless you, and glad to hear that you're doing good. And thanks for coming on All Marine Radio, talking about Turner Construction. For those of you listening, Turner's got 40 to 50 slots that they're looking for veterans, and they're partial to people that have served in a combat theater. You don't have to be a grunt or a machine gunner to go to work for them, but they are looking for those kind of problem solving and leadership skills. So all you got to do is shoot either me an email or Bob Nielsen an email, and we will we'll get the ball rolling and get you pointed in the right direction. So, but it always helps, Pat, to hear guys that have gone down that road, who've done it, who can come on and say, hey, yeah, you know, if you're interested, they're a great company, and by all means. So, thanks for doing this.
Absolutely, it's my pleasure.
The one and only from Rhode Island, Pat Murray, Marine Corps, Corporal Machine Gunner, 0331 type, walking in the footsteps of his uncle who walked through the Chosen Reservoir. So, again, Pat, have a great day. Thanks for doing this, and I'll be in touch, bud.
You too. Sounds good. Have a great one.
Yep, I will. There you have it. That is Pat Murray. I love this job. You know, I get to meet these kind of guys, and it's extremely cool. So, we'll take a break. And again, Bob Nielsen, you can find him on Facebook. You can find him via 100 Entrepreneurs, NILSSON, Nielsen. Or you can just shoot an email to All Marine Radio. So if you're interested in a career in leadership and management, in construction, as I said, it sounds a lot like what non-commissioned officers do, what junior officers do, in the United States military. So if you have that skill set, Turner's looking for you. More of, the Gunner's going to join us on a Thursday. Next, right here on, a Thursday edition of All Marine Radio, right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. So whatever you do, don't touch that dial.